This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Michael Schaefer and his wife rescued Murphy, a sweet, cuddly, and goofy St. Bernard, from a shelter, it led Schaefer into the world of contemporary pet ownership, a world of doggy antidepressants, dog park politics, dog furniture, organic pet food, and a whole service industry of grooming, training, and caretaking. In his book, One Nation Under Dog, Schaefer says America's house pets have worked their way into a new place in the hearts, homes, and wallets of their owners. One Nation Under Dog comes out in paperback next week. Schaefer is a journalist who has been a staff writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer and U.S. News & World Report. Michael Schaefer, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, I don't want people to think that your book mocks people who love their animals and mocks people who spend money on their animals, but you do take a look at that phenomenon. So what are you trying to get at in the book?
Well, I guess I wanted to sit down and write a book about how it is that we became this pampered pet nation. You kind of can't go a week or two reading a newspaper without seeing some crazy story about what people do for their animals. You know, it's the dog with the pink mohair sweater, or look at these people, they feed organic cat food. And these stories tend to have a kind of undercurrent of derision in them. You know, this is a sign of frivolity and over-the-top excess, particularly in these dark economic times, this is out of place. And I felt that way when I got a dog. My wife and I, remember we were driving to this shelter where we knew this dog we wanted was available. And it was about 2.5 hours from our house. And the whole way up, we were talking about how, well, we're not going to become like those people, the ones that we had heard about. And we were saying, you know, we're not going to do this, and we're not going to do this, and we're not going to do this. And, of course, then the dog arrives, and all of that goes out the window. And it doesn't go out the window because he's so cute and melts your heart, although that helps. It goes out the window because a lot of the stuff people do for their pets now is just an inevitable reaction or reflection of the society we live in.
Let me ask you to give an example, and here's the one I'm thinking of. A lot of people make fun of animals who are taking things like antidepressants.
Right.
Your dog on antidepressants, right? Because of what?
Well, we had jobs, and we had this dog at home. And we live in a little row house in Philadelphia, and our next-door neighbors are retired, and they're home all day. And one night they came to us and said, you know, that dog of yours yaps from the minute you guys leave in the morning till the minute you guys come home. And this was a time when he would also go to the bathroom in the house when we left. We would take turns rushing home at lunch, you know, hoping to head it off, which didn't usually work. And, you know, it was quite clearly in distress. And, you know, I mentioned this to the vet kind of in passing, more thinking, hey, do you have any, you know, behavior type techniques I could do to help him relax? And the vet said, you know, there's a drug for that. It's called separation anxiety. That's the condition he's got. And there is a canine version of a human tricyclic antidepressant. The only actual chemical difference is that the pills are beef flavored. And, you know, this was this thing my in-laws, my uncles were saying, you know, you're giving your dog antidepressants? I mean, what's the matter with this country where even our dogs are on antidepressants? Aren't they supposed to be the happiest creatures in the world? And, you know, I guess if you step back and look at it that way, it seems kind of silly. But as a very practical matter, we should all be so lucky as to have had the positive effect he had from the medication. And, you know, we're at a time when we humans are quite comfortable with psychopharmaceuticals. There was, maybe I shouldn't say this, but there was a time when, you know, all three members of our household were using some sort of antidepressant. Now he's the only one. But you know, it's all just to say that we humans are quite comfortable with this. Lots of people do it. It's not weird. It doesn't mean you're crazy. And as you see this with a lot of things in the pet spending world, where things that we experience and kind of think of as normal, we will go and ask, hey, can I do that for my dog or my cat?
But as you point out in your book, putting your dog on antidepressants because of separation anxiety, mm-hmm. his separation anxiety, mm-hmm. is a reflection on how humans live now.
Absolutely.
I mean, there used to be a time when a family that had a dog typically had a mother homemaker who was there all day, who was there with the dog. Or there were kids of different ages, and there was a young kid at home to play with the dog. There was a yard that the dog could run around in. And now you've got dogs cooped up at home with nobody home to play them, nothing to play with them, nothing to occupy them. And so it puts the dog in a position of great discomfort because they have no activity and no company.
That's absolutely right. And I mean, you know, I write in my book that an anthropologist from Mars or something that showed up here and had only the contents of like a PetSmart to look at could figure out a great deal about our human society.
What would they learn?
They would learn, among others. I mean, they, looking at just this question, they would learn that we are a society where two career couples are the norm in a lot of places. And that has led to a whole bunch of things. It's led to more dogs being alone more of the time. It's led to these very elaborate chew toys that I write about, where you know these toys are basically designed to keep the pet entertained during these very long absences of its people, and they have all of these devices to kind of make it complicated to get a piece of food out from the middle, and the idea is that a dog, you know, with this toy thrown to him in the morning as the owner heads off for the day, will actually spend a couple of hours trying to manipulate it and chew on it in a certain way that makes the food pop out and so on. And at the end of that, the dog will be exhausted. He'll be mentally stimulated, which is great on a theoretical level. He also won't spend the rest of the day destroying your couch, which has a more practical benefit for humans. So people still want pets. They want them, I think, more than they ever did. And they are adjusting the nature of pet keeping in such ways as to reflect the other aspects of how we live.
And that's part of the reason why a whole pet services industry, a huge pet services industry has grown
right,
up.
Right.
Give us an overview of some of the services available for pets now.
Well, you can find some really crazy examples of wealth and excess in pet services, and you can also find some very practical things.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a day driving around Manhattan with this pet taxi driver, and his company would take calls from people saying, you know, I need to take my dog to the vet. Manhattan's a place where a lot of people don't have cars, and you can't just take any old pet on the subway, and a lot of cabs won't stop for you. So it's actually a practical need that was being filled. And there's also this incredibly fast-growing business of professional dog grooming. And, you know, to me, it is connected fairly intimately with this change in where people's pets have literally lived over the years. In the old days, it was pretty common to have your dog especially sleep out back for the night in the doghouse or out in the yard. I actually saw an article in a business journal that sort of traced images of dogs in advertisements in women's magazines over the course of the 20th century. And in the 1920s, the sort of prototypical picture would be of a stylish woman out on the street walking her dog in public. And by the 50s, you'd have the dog kind of curled up on the hearth in the living room. And by the 80s and 90s, you had this image of, you know, like an aspirin ad where the mom is supplying medicine to the sick child and the dog is literally on the child's bed. So it's this kind of progression indoors and into the family and into the bedroom. I don't think it's any surprise, given that I think I saw a statistic that said 47% of people have their pet sleep in their own bed. I don't think it's any surprise given
sleep
that.
In the people's bed.
Sleep in the people's bed. I don't think it's any surprise given that those people are going to be a lot more interested in getting their dog groomed because you don't want to sleep with a stinky dog.
I know that there are dog parks in most cities. Do you have a dog park to take Murphy to?
Not officially. in my neighborhood, there's, you know, but it's interesting you ask that because when we got Murphy and began taking him to this park in the neighborhood where everybody takes their dogs, you know, it was like I was Margaret Mead and it just landed in Samoa. There was this this very intricate network of rules and what you're supposed to do and what you're not supposed to do, and no one wrote them down, no one told you them, but you just sort of figured them out. And you could see how the people who were regulars at the park would, you know, shun people who engaged in behavior that wasn't cool or subtly remind you of what you're supposed to do. You know, heaven forbid that you let your dog poop and don't pick it up, because everyone will remind you. But there's other types of things which, as I went around, I visit a lot of dog parks. There's great variation among dog parks, and even these informal ones, in terms of what is permitted and what isn't. And I'm not, again, talking about a written list of rules.
Give me an example.
Well, in my neighborhood, I live in a sort of college-y neighborhood right by a university. And one thing dogs do in dog parks is they hump. And, you know, most of the time people have a kind of dogs will be dogs attitude. Well, you know, that's what they do. They're dogs. And, you know, sometimes if there's a new person, people will try to get their dog to not do that because they don't know how the new person will react. But that tends to be how it works. There's another very nice, actually legal, official dog park in a kind of ritzy part of town that we take our dog to sometimes. And there, it's really not okay.
So are you a regular now at the dog park? You know all the rules?
I'm a regular there, not because I know all the rules, but because it's the closest thing to my house.
Right, right.
And it's actually been a place where, you know, I spend an hour a day there. And I've made a lot of friends. And one of our closest friends in our city is someone we met through the park. And I think this is quite typical, this idea of...
That's a point you make in your book, that dogs are a way of connecting to other people in addition to having a connection to the dogs, and in a society where we're growing increasingly isolated.
Right. And this is something that's been the subject of a certain amount of scholarly research, but it's something I've also sort of experienced in my own life at my neighborhood dog park. And I've also sort of seen it in action, and I've written about some of the business people who are trying to take advantage of it. In Austin, Texas, I remember visiting a bar that had a yappy hour, I believe, every Wednesday or Thursday night. And it was a great idea. I mean, whoever thought of it.
You bring your pet with you?
Bring your pet with you. And you know, it was outdoors, and they had put out some dog bowls, and probably a quiet night of the week. And it was a great way of drumming up business. The people who were there loved it because, for them, you know, having to rush home from work every day and walk the dog, while a pleasure, also, you know, sort of impeded on their social life a little bit. And this was a way to combine the two. And as ornate as a lot of city dog parks may be now, very few of them serve beer.
You know, you mentioned earlier that more people seem to have pets now than ever before. And if that's true, have you thought about the reasons why that might be true?
The most convincing of the reasons I've heard, and I can't claim to have come up with it myself, traces the point where the growth of the pet population began to grow faster than the human population to the 1960s, late 60s. And the argument is that this is the same time when we began moving further from families and more divorce and people leaving tight-knit urban neighborhoods in favor of a more isolated suburban lifestyle, and a kind of broad array of social support mechanisms going away. And that one thing people did was turn to pets to help fill that void. And I think it also explains the role that pets were given in this new world, that they were considered much more as full-fledged members of the family with all of our obligations to them than in the old days. If you walk through a pet cemetery, you know, you can kind of see this in real time. Some of the very old graves are likely to say, or liable to say, you know, here lies Fido, a loyal servant. And newer ones you'll find, you know, here lies Fido, my best friend. Or often, and there are all these internet sites where people can write tributes to their recently deceased pets, and it'll say, my baby, or Fido was my child, except that his name is not so likely to be Fido anymore. I actually saw some statistics from a pet insurance company about what the most common names of policyholders was, and it was like Max and Jake and Chloe and Julie, which are also pretty common names for babies nowadays.
You have a chapter on basically dog training culture wars. You compare two different styles of dog training, and what are the different styles, and what do they tell you about our culture today?
Right. Well, there is the number of, according to the federal government, the number of animal trainers in the country tripled in just 6 years between 2000 and 2006. And, you know, one of the reasons for this is as I said, that getting dog training has become, for a lot of middle-class pet owners, a kind of basic, normal, responsible thing you do to be a good citizen. And there has been this wildly popular and really good TV show called The Dog Whisperer, starring Cesar Millan, which is like a weekly advertisement for the concept of dog training. You see him go, you know, you might imagine hiring a dog trainer is something that only, you know, absurdly rich people do, or you only do if you want to train a seeing eye dog or a stunt dog or something. And that's how it used to be, or at least you'd only do if you had kind of a problem dog. And, you know, watching The Dog Whisperer, you actually see him go into these houses of perfectly normal people. Granted, normal people whose dogs are acting in ways they don't want, but people who are not fancy spendthrift types. The thing is, though, that this growth of this industry has masked or hasn't made up for the fact that there are wildly divergent views about what the most effective and most humane way to train a dog is. For most of the 20th century, since the sort of dawn of kind of modern dog training, which was geared, again, towards police dogs and Hollywood dogs and whatever, it was this very rote military-style training. Actually, the first prominent dog trainer was in the Prussian police force. So you can imagine it was sort of in his image, and it was, if the dog, you know, doesn't behave in the right way, jerk its chain. And that idea kind of carried through most of the 20th century. There was this pedagogical revolution in the 70s and 80s among trainers who thought, hey, maybe actually positive reinforcement, you know, hitting him with a reward as quickly as possible after he does something well, is a more effective way to train. The argument was that dogs are too dumb to figure out why it is you're kicking them. So if you were trying to correct some bad behavior, it's difficult to do that through these purely negative ways. And this positive reinforcement model kind of became the standard among professionals, and academically based professionals as well as trainers and who might hang out a shingle and so on, until Caesar's show went on the air. And his idea is quite different. It's that, you know, there is this natural order of things as existed in a pack of wild wolves, where the alpha dog was the boss and the other dogs were subordinate. And his idea is the problem for American dogs, the problem with their behavior, is that we have lost touch with the natural order of things, and that the way to shape a dog's behavior is to remind it that you, the human, are its alpha. Which seems good in theory, but to a lot of the positive trainers, the ways he gets to that are considered cruel or at least impractical. And they see all this sort of talk about nature as just a mask for a return to this old-fashioned, dominant, top-down model. And to my mind, it all plays out kind of like a version of the culture wars over how to raise a kid. You know, we've got one side based in institutions and universities that has a softer, more positive approach. You have another side that says our society has gone amiss because we've lost our discipline and lost our sense of authority. And, you know, it sounds awfully familiar.
Which kind of which approach did you go with your training?
We hired a woman who, because we didn't know anything about this, we, you know, hired a woman who had a good website and we liked her a lot, who had a kind of alpha approach. And it was this, you know, when you go through a door, you go first. Murphy doesn't go first. That way
you got to teach him who's boss.
Right. And when you come home, don't pet him. Once he has calmed down, call him over to the couch and then pet him. And she was we really like her. And she, you know, things I'm saying may, you know, sort of removed from the experience might sound kind of monstrous, but the argument was this is what will make him feel better, that, you know, any behavior problems he has have to do with anxiety over who's the boss, and that dogs, unlike humans, are not sitting around scheming, hoping to become the boss, but that what they do need is a secure sense of where they are in the order of things. So it was, you know, put out his food for exactly 20 minutes a day, then put it away. He has to know that he's going to eat on your schedule, not on his. And, you know, he doesn't get to come on the bed, and when you walk him, you know, hold the leash tight, and he doesn't get to decide where you go, and that sort of thing. And it, you know, it worked.
Michael Schaefer, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Schaefer is the author of One Nation Under Dog. The paperback edition will be published next week. Our interview was recorded last year when the book came out in hardcover. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you haven't seen Fantastic Mr. Fox, you have a second chance. It just came out on DVD and Blu-ray. The film was nominated for 2 Oscars, Best Animated Film and Best Original Score. We're going to hear the interview I recorded with Wes Anderson, who directed and co-wrote the film. Anderson also made the movies Rushmore, The Royal Tenenbaums, and The Darjeeling Limited. Fantastic Mr. Fox is Anderson's first animated film. It uses miniature animal puppets and miniature sets animated through stop-motion photography to create a visually amazing world. The story is adapted from a children's book by Roald Dahl, but the movie adds new characters and storylines. At the beginning of the story, Mr. Fox moves his wife and son to a new home near 3 evil farmers. Mr. Fox has promised Mrs. Fox that he'll never steal chickens again, because as a father, he couldn't risk being captured. But he succumbs to his animal instincts and steals some of the farmers' chickens. After that, the farmers are on the warpath against Mr. Fox and his family. Wes Anderson, welcome back to Fresh Air. Now, I never read Roald Dahl. I never read Fantastic Mr. Fox, but I got a copy after seeing your film. What did the book mean to you, and why did you want to adapt it into a film?
Well, it was the first Roald Dahl book that I ever read as a child, and I became a huge fan of Dahl, and he was a big part of my childhood. For some reason, this book was the one I always kept with me. Wherever I lived when I went to college, I always had this book on my shelves. It's a slim book, and it's really kind of, I think it's for young children. But something about it always stuck with me. And I think it's the character of Mr. Fox is a very dull kind of figure, and he's the one who rescues everybody, but he's also the cause of all of their problems, and his personality gets them into these problems in the first place. And I think something about that grabbed me. And at a certain point, I started thinking I would like to do a stop motion film, and a stop motion film with puppets with fur. And this was a good opportunity for that. This connected with that.
You've added a lot of adult themes to this children's story. And by adult, I don't mean sexual. I mean more existential. And Mr. and Mrs. Fox used to steal chickens, but after getting trapped and nearly getting killed or losing their freedom in a cage, he swears he's going to give up stealing chickens, and he becomes a newspaper columnist instead. But he still has the hunger for chickens and for the adventure. And he has an existential crisis. Who is he? Is he a
yes,
fox?
I think he. I think he likes the word existentialism more than anything else.
I want to play a clip in which he decides to go back to stealing chickens again, and he enlists his not very bright possum friend to be his accomplice. So this is Mr. Fox with his friend the possum, Kylie.
Who am I, Kylie?
Who, how? What now?
Why a fox? Why not a horse or a beetle or a bald eagle? I'm saying this more as, like, existentialism, you know? Who am I? And how can a fox ever be happy without you'll forgive the expression, a chicken in its teeth?
I don't know what you're talking about, but it sounds illegal.
Here, put this bandit hat on. Maybe you're a medium. Take it off for a minute, and don't wait around the house.
I really love that. So what does it mean to be a fox? I love the idea that these animals are, that this animal in particular is having an identity crisis about whether he should be overcoming his fox instincts or not.
Yes, he's a bit obsessed with the idea of being a wild animal.
And, you know, the creatures in the film, you know, like they're all dressed as humans with, like, you know, suits and ties and dresses, they have like kitchens and living rooms and furniture, but underneath it all, I mean, they're animals. So like, there's this wonderful scene at the kitchen table where Mr. Fox is reading a newspaper, and Mrs. Fox brings out the pancakes for the family. But once they start eating, they just like. Like, you know, eat it like animals, because that's what they are. And it's so
yes.
funny. And there's another scene like that I want to play, just to give our listeners a sense of the story. And this is a scene where Mr. Fox, played by George Clooney, is talking to his lawyer, a badger played by Bill Murray. And the lawyer is advising him not to move into a house right near the really mean farmers who would probably like to kill a fox. So here's that scene.
In summation, I think you just got to not do it, man. That's all.
I understand what you're saying, and your comments are valuable, but I'm going to ignore your advice.
The cuss you are.
The cuss am I? Are you cussing with me?
No, you cussing with me.
Don't cuss and point
you're
at me.
You're going to cuss with somebody. You're not going to cuss with me, you little cuss.
Just by the tree.
Okay.
I love that. The way they actually like become animals.
Yes, it kicks in.
Yeah. And you use the word cuss through the movie instead of the F word. How did you decide cuss would be your substitute?
Well, I don't even remember. I think it was just to try to use the concept of profanity as a replacement for the profanity itself. It turns out to be very versatile.
Yes, you do use it very versatilely. So, as the director and co-writer of the film, did you actually create the miniature animals?
Yes. You know, a movie like this, the process, I didn't know what it was going to be like to make this movie when we started out. I sort of had this thought that I was going to make the script and work on the sets and then sort of prepare the shots and have this plan and then hand it over to a team of animators. And they were going to hand me back a film a year later or something. I was going to put in an order for one Fantastic Mr. Fox according to these specifications, and they would send it back. That was not what happened. It ends up being the most involving kind of filmmaking that I've ever had anything to do with, and very fun. But the thing you quickly realize is that everything that is going to go on camera has to be manufactured from scratch. Everything has to be designed, and that means every little prop and every little moment is going to have a lot of thought go into it, and it's an opportunity, but it's not going to take care of itself. Nothing's going to just be discovered like stumbling across a location.
You have to create the bodies of the animals, the clothes they wear, the houses they live in, the street they live on, the sunrise, the sunset, you know, the ground beneath their feet. You have to create absolutely everything.
Yes, it actually was quite, you know, it's rare that you get the chance to say, I have an idea for a cloud that I want to do. It's going to be, leaves and trees and everything. And I think with stop motion, it's the combination of miniature with the idea that someone is taking these, you sort of sense that someone is taking these and moving them around and bringing them to life through some sort of handmade process that's just like a sort of magic. It's like toys.
Why don't you describe how stop motion photography works?
Sure, yes. Stop motion is it's that technique where you I'll describe it, particularly in relation to our movie. It's puppets, and in our case, these puppets have metal skeletons inside them. So if you move them a little bit, they stay in position. So the animator moves the puppets one frame at a time, and each time he moves it, so to complete an action, he poses it many, many times and takes a picture each time he reposes it, and then those are played back quickly, and it appears to move around, and that's really the basic technique of the whole movie, this old-fashioned style of animation.
So do you need to have a little bit of OCD, obsessive-compulsive disorder, to work in stop-time animation, because everything has to be handmade, and then you have to move each puppet like a fraction of an inch for each frame that you're shooting?
Yes, well, it's, you know, the people who actually do the physical process of animating, they have to be experts. They have to be very experienced, and they have to be supremely talented to do this. And there aren't that many people to do it. So it's a special personality type. It's special talents. And, you know, when you prepare a shot for a stop motion film. When you prepare the shot, you draw what you want the shot to be. You've recorded the voices already, and you work with the animator to make a plan of what's going to happen in time. The animator has a sheet that's prepared that shows what happens on each frame. So when you study the sheet, you'll see on frame 220, a character is beginning to lift his arm and pronouncing a sh sound. You know, it's down to the syllables. You know, there's four frames where he's pronouncing sh, and then he's moving to the next thing. It's the most detailed preparation you could possibly have for a shot, and yet each animator will surprise you with how he interprets this incredibly precise plan. And that's sort of the part that you just can't understand. Something happens, you know, they work in this very, very gradual process, but they're doing something that is just, that really is like magic. And it isn't just moving the puppet around, it's making it seem like it's alive.
Right. And I know I want you to describe in detail one of the puppets, maybe Mr. Fox.
Okay. Mr. Fox, that puppet is, let's say he's maybe 13 inches tall, the main puppet, the main puppet of the, I'll explain what I mean. There are different scales. So a full scale, what we call a full scale Mr. Fox puppet is about 13 inches tall. It has this steel or titanium skeleton that has joints in it, and even joints in the fingers and many bones in the face. And it has fur over it. It has eyes that move around separately, and you can move them with a little pin. And it's got a costume.
Describe the costume.
The costume is sort of rust-colored corduroy suit with a terry cloth shirt with yellow zigzags on it. And he has a, and you know, I saw one of our people making something one day. I was like, "What are you working on?" It was he has little stalks of wheat in his pocket, like cigars or something. And this one of the people who works in the props department was making wheat, and to see somebody make tiny, tiny miniature wheat, it's just you know you're dealing with a whole other realm than you've ever experienced.
Stop motion photography was developed, I think, for the movie King Kong, used again in Mighty Joe Young and other adventure films. Were you a big fan of King Kong when you were growing up or when you became an adult?
Yeah, I loved King Kong. You know, what I grew up, I think when I became aware of stop motion was, I can't remember the name of the guy, Willis maybe? Is Willis, something like Willis is the guy who did the stop motion on King Kong. And his protege was Ray Harryhausen, who's sort of the most famous stop motion guy ever. And he did a number, but the ones I saw were the ones that are sort of Greek mythology. Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, Jason and the Argonauts. There's another Sinbad movie also. Things like the Clash of the Titans. Those movies all have a big stop motion element to them. And I really loved them as a kid. And also there were these TV, the holiday specials that the Rankin Bass Company did, the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and there's one about there's one that's sort of the story of how Santa Claus came to be. Those were ones that my brothers and I were really taken with.
Now there's a sport that's played in Fantastic Mr. Fox, and I think this is a sport that you made up. That's not in the book, and it's called Whack Bat. And I want to play a short scene in which the rules of the game are explained. These are, like, wonderful rules. And Owen Wilson, who's in a lot of your movies, he plays the coach. And in this scene, what we're going to hear is the coach explaining the rules of whack bat to the perfect cousin, Christofferson, because he's going to put Christofferson in as a replacement for Ash. So the coach is played by Owen Wilson, who's in a lot of your films. Ash is played by Jason Schwartzman, and the cousin is played by your brother, Eric Anderson.
Basically, there's three grabbers, three taggers, five twig runners, and the player at whack bat. The center tagger lights a pine cone, chucks it over the basket, and the whack batter tries to hit the cedar stick off the cross rock. Then the twig runners dash back and forth until the pine cone burns out and the umpire calls hot box. Finally, at the end, you count up however many score downs it adds up to and divide that by 9.
Got it.
Going for Ash. Substitution! Ash, come out. You need a breather.
What? Come out?
What? I still feel good, coach. Let me finish this eighth.
No. Come on. Step out. Step out. Let's go.
Am I getting better, coach?
Well, you're sure as cuss not getting any worse.
Really? I mean, you think I could end up being as good as my dad if I keep practicing?
Your dad? Your dad was probably the best whack bat player we ever had in this school.
No, you don't want to have to compare yourself to that.
So it's another scene from Fantastic Mr. Fox. I love the description of the rules of Whack Bat. And if you're not an athlete and don't follow sports closely, that's how a lot of sports rules sound to you. So yes. What about you? Do you follow sports carefully, or do they all sound as ridiculous as Whack Bat?
Well, I used to follow certain sports so much more carefully. Like the 1975 baseball season, I know every single player, every detail of it, but I know absolutely nothing about it right now. And I used to follow tennis very closely, but cricket, for instance, is incomprehensible to me. We made the movie in England, and I hadn't really watched a cricket match before. In fact, I'd seen a couple in India, but I've never been able to grasp the first thing about how that operates. It doesn't really seem to make any sense. But this game has especially complicated rules.
Your new film, Fantastic Mr. Fox, is almost like a musical in the sense that there's so much underscoring through the film, and then there's some records used through the film. And so I want to talk a little bit about the music. Let's start with why there is so much of it in the movie.
Well, you know, with most animated films, it's sort of wall-to-wall music. And I didn't really expect to do that. But I guess what usually happens with me is I sort of put in as much music as the movie feels like it's willing to accommodate. I like music in movies. In the case of this one, I had a couple of ideas at the beginning. One was that I thought the score could have a kind of Peter and the Wolf element where we would assign certain instruments to different characters. And it ended up being that, you know, Mr. Fox sort of has this banjo that goes with them, and the farmers have different horns, you know, there's a rat that has sort of whistling in a Spanish style, kind of flamenco guitar. But the main score is written by Alexandre Desplat, who sort of took a lot of different influences and ideas that we had and pulled them all together and invented his own his own version of all that.
The very first song that we hear, though, is this.
Born on a mountaintop in Tennessee, green estate in the land of the free, raised in the woods so's he knew every tree, killed him a bar when he was only three. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier.
So what is the Ballad of Davy Crockett from the Walt Disney TV show doing in your movie?
Well, somewhere along the way, I started thinking, often I don't really know exactly why I suddenly say have an idea like this, but and in this case, I almost feel like his hat may have a relationship to our main character,
Tail, because of the tail,
yeah, just because you know he looks like he'd be wearing Mr. Fox on his head, but at a certain point, I started sort of thinking I would like to use music. From children's films and children's entertainment anyway. And we ended up with, we have Davy Crockett that's at the beginning of the movie, and we have three different songs that are by Burl Ives, who's actually in some of the, when I refer to the Rankin Bass holiday specials, he's involved in at least one of them. And we have music from the Disney Robin Hood. And so it sort of became part of the whole, you know, we also have the Beach Boys and the Rolling Stones.
Wes Anderson, thank you so much for talking with us, and congratulations on the film.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you for having me.
Wes Anderson, he directed and co-wrote Fantastic Mr. Fox, which just came out on DVD and Blu-ray. This is Fresh Air. Writer and director Noah Baumbach is best known for his autobiographical 2005 drama, The Squid and the Whale, the story of two brothers devastated by their parents' divorce. His new film, Greenberg, also features two brothers. The film focuses on Roger Greenberg, played by Ben Stiller, a depressed 40-year-old who is still unsure what to do with his life. He's house-sitting in L.A. for his more successful sibling. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Noah Baumbach has gotten rave reviews for making the title character of Greenberg, played by Ben Stiller, largely unsympathetic. It's true, it takes guts for Baumbach and Stiller to flout the Hollywood laws of likability so baldly, to make Roger Greenberg, a 40-ish, unemployed New York carpenter in L.A. to house sit for his wealthy brother, not a charming jerk, but a mopey, jerky jerk. But I wonder if there's a limit to how self-centered, how small you can make a character before you're punishing the audience. It's a line that has gotten more vague now that audiences are turned on by the aesthetic of Squirm. You watch Larry David in Curb Your Enthusiasm as he turns simple encounters into protracted psychodramas and think, is this funny or painful? Ideally, it's both. And when the approach works, as in Albert Brooks's Lost in America, you laugh at how these people can be so unaware of how ridiculous they look. It's their lack of embarrassment that makes them embarrassing. But Greenberg is meant to be dark and uncomfortably real, part of the indie genre dubbed mumblecore, in which characters grope through life without knowing what they want or even how they feel. The question is not what's eating Greenberg, but what isn't? He's prickly. He's paranoid. He's an injustice collector. He writes long letters to companies to avenge small slights. He's been hospitalized for depression. And it's possible to sympathize with his annoyance when a noisy family with permission to use his brother's pool invades his blessed silence. But then comes the scene with his brother's personal assistant, Florence, played by Greta Gerwig, a bright young woman barely holding her life together. Greenberg gets drunk, as he often does, and paws her with no preamble, no banter, no smile, just a caveman sense of entitlement. And she doesn't slug him. She has so little self-worth, she thinks Roger is relationship material. Baumbach, in his way, thinks so too. On one hand, he seizes every opportunity to score points off the character, building scenes to expose Roger's pretentiousness, so there's nothing to do but sit and wait for him to appall you again. On the other hand, Baumbach paces the movie as if this stunted child man is some kind of fascinating case study, and you're invited to consider how he might be saved. Greenberg has the vague outline of a romance in which a prig learns to loosen up and care for someone else. But even Roger's breakthroughs reek of childish egotism. On their own terms, parts of Greenberg are perversely entertaining. Rhys Ifans plays the ex-bandmate Roger once let down by walking away from a recording contract. Their scenes are droopy and awkward, amusing for the ways in which Roger doesn't register his friend's everlasting hurt.
People don't call on my birthday anymore. I guess they don't call people on their birthdays. Why should they call me?
I didn't call you. When's yours?
November.
That's right. I'll call you this year.
Way over that. We're taking it this time.
Laughing already demonstrates appreciation. The applause seems superfluous. And also, it's like, just treat the restaurant like it's your living room, guy. I'm weirdly on tonight.
Shall we order?
Maybe I should have invited Florence. Or I should have had a party.
Birthdays are hard, man.
It's a weird aging, right?
Youth is wasted on the young.
I'd go further. I'd go, life is wasted on people.
In Greta Gerwig, Baumbach has an attractively flighty heroine. Early on, when Florence is running errands for Roger's brother's family, Gerwig fairly sings her lines, the melody keeping her buoyed up through the indignities of servitude. Later, when she endures Roger's passive-aggressive abuse, she clings to her spaciness, as if to keep his craziness at bay. Greenberg might be a heck of a movie if we could just get Greenberg out of there. Baumbach and cinematographer Harris Savides create layers and levels of space to suggest a world with so much stuff, furniture, swimming pools, drugs, that people can go through life without connecting. But Roger doesn't connect with us. Even damaged, unpleasant characters need dramatic stature, something that transcends individual foolishness and strikes a larger chord. Greenberg is a one-note sonata.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.